Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to the April edition of Wireless here on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. A warm welcome also to our listeners on Phoenix FM and Near FM in Dublin, Clare Morris Community Radio in Mayo, Wired FM in Limerick and WGXC in Columbia County, New York. Wireless is the radio programme all about radio, local, regional and national broadcasters, pirate and free radio, DAB and podcasting, and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on this month's edition of Wireless, political support for a public service broadcast fund for commercial radio, a new book about a century of Irish radio, a feature on Dublin City FM and the country's longest-running hospital radio station.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Last month, we interviewed John Purcell of Independent Broadcasters of Ireland about the organisation's campaign against government policy on broadcasting and its call for support from the public purse for the public service obligations of commercial radio. The IBI argues that competition from social media has undermined its business model and that it can no longer afford to fund high-quality news and current affairs to the same extent as before. Fianna Fáil has proposed a public service broadcast fund as part of a series of measures to support commercial radio. I spoke to its spokesperson on communications, Timmy Dooley, TD.
Yeah, I think it's well recognised now that the independent radio sector, in addition to the work of the national broadcaster, provides a lot of good public service broadcasting, particularly in the area of news and current affairs. The license provided to the independent sector requires them to carry certain content, particularly in the area of news and current affairs. It's an expensive job to provide that. It's costly, but it's ultimately what listeners are looking for and what they need. The difficulty really has been that the independent sector had initially relied on the commercial market through the sale of advertising in many cases to fund their operations. We know over the last number of years, certainly in the last 5 years, there has been a very significant shift in commercial advertising moving to the digital platforms, to the various different social media platforms who have a very targeted approach. Have huge viewers right across the world and are able to provide tailored packages to certain advertisers. And that's impacting on the ability of the independent radio sector to effectively carry out, in the first instance, to put the news together and to be able to broadcast it. So I've felt that the only way to protect, particularly much of this news and current affairs being of a local nature, and we see the potential for it effectively to be lost if we don't put in place this fund. So the Fianna Fáil proposal is to take a relatively small amount of money from the overall broadcasting fund, which comes through the licence fee, assign it to a fund that would support the independent local and regional and community radio stations.
And how would the fund work then on a practical level? How would it be given out? How would it be shared?
Well, it's my view that's not an issue for politicians or politics generally, and our proposal would see the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland take responsibility for that. They're recognised as being independent. They already administer the Sound and Vision Fund. And I think for that reason, they would be the appropriate state entity to act in an independent manner and for them then to draw up guidelines and effectively set the criteria around which the funding would be drawn down. But the money would be ring-fenced for all of the stations other than the national broadcaster who's already covered in the existing licensing arrangement, license fee arrangement.
And what stage is this initiative at now politically? I know there was a motion that was presented to the Dáil about this recently. At what stage, what status does the initiative have in terms of the legislative process, for instance?
We published a bill previously, but because of the way in which government controls the legislature to a large extent, the bill hasn't been able to move forward because it requires the government to accept, even in advance of it getting to the floor, the government have to accept it and allow it to progress. That hasn't happened. So I took another initiative then, which was to have a motion debated in the House to try and seek support from all the political parties. And it did. It received unanimous support. So I'd be hoping now that the next phase of this would be that the other political parties will take the initiative on board, having supported in the Dáil, and will make commitments as we face into the next election, make commitments in their manifestos that during the lifetime of the next administration that they will support the introduction of such a measure and see an appropriate funding stream to assist the independent local and community radio sector.
So what about the argument that, local commercial radio applied for licences in the full knowledge that they had a 20% news and current affairs requirement? And also, you know, many Irish radio stations are owned by large communications companies, essentially, large and well-financed companies. So why should the taxpayer have to pick up the tab for providing a statutory requirement that they knew they already had to sign up for?
Yeah, I think they knew that they had signed up for it. And my concern would be that over time, the vast majority of the independent radio sector, as they renew licences, will seek to get derogations from their obligation to carry news and current affairs. I think that would be very negative. I think it would impact on our democracy. The big concern that I have around all of this is that on the digital platforms, which are now attracting the commercial revenues, there's the real potential for fake news. Whereas local radio stations and local newspapers to a large extent also have appropriately edited, appropriately curated local news and current affairs information, and I think it's a vital service to inform the public in an impartial and an unbiased way. So it's really important that we recognise the challenge which we face, which is the inability of the radio stations to carry to the broadest extent possible, appropriately edited and properly verified news and current affairs information. You take examples on a local level, the capacity to do court reports, to cover county council meetings, in some cases to cover local matches, issues of local interest, whether they be sort of historical events or social community events. Those are costly services to cover. I mean, it would be possible for, of course, some of the local radio stations to churn out national news and current affairs that would be syndicated by one particular company. I don't think that would, whilst it might meet the requirement of the licence, I don't think it would serve the local communities to the way that we would want them in terms of ensuring that they have access to quality, verified news and current affairs. So part of it is actually working against, in the first instance, the potential for fake news to develop in the absence of properly curated and appropriately verified local news and current affairs. And that's the challenge that's coming and being provided by these digital platforms.
Yeah, but that's the argument I'm making is related to, I mean, essentially a moral argument that these are private companies, so why should they be supported by taxpayer?
In principle, I don't have a problem if they're providing the service that's required of them by the BAI. It's not about putting money into the bottom line of these companies. It's about ensuring that they continue to provide an important service that I believe is important to protect the principles of democracy in the state. If that has to be paid for, then so be it. And I think that's where, you know, you would see it as grant aid from the state or from the taxpayer, but properly and independently worked through by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, and ensuring that each of the stations do so to a very high standard.
Can I ask you about community radio? Because obviously I'm calling you from a community station, and community radio is far more cash strapped than the commercial stations that we've been discussing. And, you know, there's no core funding, guaranteed core funding for community radio in this country. It's consistently on the edge. It is arguably far closer to some of the principles of democracy and participation that you have mentioned in relation to the commercial companies. Where does community radio feature in your initiative?
Yeah, I think there has to be an entire review of the community radio sector. I mean, I'm familiar with quite a number of them. And in many cases, the difficulty is that they just get a short-term license on FM, and then they've got to broadcast over the internet for prolonged periods of time, which doesn't really help them about, you know, developing their listenership and maintaining that. I certainly think there's a strong argument to ensure that there is a stream of funding, but I'm also conscious that there's a very strong voluntary effort there that I think doesn't need to be lost either. So it's about finding a model that assists them in getting their service on air, but still remaining very much in touch and part of the community at a micro level.
But community radio stations have obligations in relation to news and current affairs as well. So does your initiative exclude them or include them?
No, it doesn't exclude them at all. It doesn't exclude them at all. And I think we've made that very clear over time that there needs to be a review of how the whole community radio sector is operated and licensed, and that it should have the capacity to operate for much longer periods of time and be effectively more established and recognised by the state in that regard.
So when your bill, if your bill is brought forward, if you manage to get through the legislative process, then does it specifically deal with the community radio sector?
No, it doesn't. But that's what I'm saying. I'm prepared to look at that from a policy perspective to include methods of assisting the community radio sector, because I believe that they certainly warrant support in the work that they do.
Deputy Timmy Dooley of Fianna Fáil speaking about his party's proposal for the Public Service Broadcast Fund.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
As regular listeners to Wireless will know, we're big fans of pirate radio and have featured over several programmes the commemorations of the close downs of the Irish pirates at the end of 1988 and our own website pirate.ie. We've also spoken in the past to broadcast historian Eddie Bowen, who has donated his extensive archive of written materials related to pirate radio to Dublin City University. Eddie has just published a new book called A Century of Irish Radio, 1900 to 2000, and earlier I caught up with him to hear all about it.
The reason that I thought the book was needed was it's been a long time since anything as comprehensive has been written about radio, and very little has been written about pirate radio, which is a huge revolutionary part of Irish broadcasting. The last really big book was Maurice Gorham's book in 1966, which focused on the launch of 2RN and Radio Éireann. So this has been, I suppose, ticking around in my head for a long time. I actually was going back through some of my notes that I was writing 30 years ago. I was writing down handwritten notes, and then my mother, fair play to her, at one stage, she worked in an office and she typed it up, and I have old floppy disks, real old floppy disk with the original manuscript on it. So it's been a kind of a work in progress probably for the past 25 years. And the more I looked into it, the more I realised, and the more research I'd done, the more I realised there was very little complete about Irish broadcasting had been written. Whereas there's some good sections with Helen Sheehan's, with Drama, and Robert Savage and Pines, so some really good books, kind of individuals. This I wanted to include as everybody and each decade. But again, to sort of remember that the fact that there was pirate radio that, you know, created what is today the Irish radio industry.
So it's not a book about pirate radio alone. It's a book about Irish radio over a century. But unlike other official histories of the medium, you don't leave out the pirates.
No, I don't leave out the pirates. The book starts, it goes from 1900 to 2000. So it's the early days of wireless telegraphy with Marconi's experiments in Ireland. It goes through to the 1916 Rising, where Ireland became the first nation in the world to be declared by radio. Then we go up to the 1920s, which was the birth of legal radio, which in itself was born under a bit of a cloud with corruption and scandal and the odd suicide, unfortunately. And then the 1930s was where the 20s was the birth of radio, the 1930s was the evolution of radio, and the 1930s would change dramatically how the Irish listener consumed and interacted with the wireless. It changed the social aspect of Ireland, where rural Ireland began to understand that there was different accents between Donegal and Cork that may have never come across each other in their path. And it also opened up the airwaves to women and gave them a new perspective and a new independence.
And of course, radio then very closely associated with big political events. And I know you've spoken in the past about famous radio speeches that were made to mark big occasions by political leaders in Ireland, especially De Valera.
Yeah, De Valera used the radio, probably the first big manipulator of radio. But it go before that, even Arthur Griffiths was using it and obviously understood the power of radio to make sure that his address on St. Patrick's Day was always carried by a number of radio stations in America to make sure that the Irish diaspora over there weren't being left out. So it was a big thing. Radio was the way for Ireland to connect with the rest of the world. And it also changed our understanding of how the rest of the world worked. It had a very cathartic way of bringing some of Ireland together after the War of Independence and then the Civil War, because it kind of unified the nation by sitting around listening to radio. So it did change, and it opened up some of the different social schisms that was on in Ireland, you know, the battle between church and state, the battle, there was a famous anti-jazz movement back in the 1930s where some people didn't like jazz music, where they kind of categorised anything that was non-traditionally Irish as jazz music. So radio was kind of at the heart of all this. Now, having said that, in the 1930s, you could also learn how to swim on the radio, which was probably one of the more wacky ideas of radio airing.
Absolutely. That sounds like a very special programme indeed. But of course, we can't forget, Eddie, that British radio was widely available in the east part of the country, indeed over much of the country. And my own grandmother listened to Housewives Requests on BBC as a young woman. And so how much of a factor was that in the success or not of Radio Éireann? They always had the BBC looking over their shoulder.
They had, but even when N2RN started in 1926, those who had or could afford radios at the time were already listening to radio for the previous 4 or 5 years, listening to Birmingham or listening to London. So they already knew what they wanted. And unfortunately, when 2RN started, where they were trying to be all things to everyone, it wasn't what the people who had radios already wanted to listen to. So the British radio had a huge influence on not so much what RT or Radio Ireland put out, because, again, they were constrained by financial problems, but it did force the appetite for the listener to change, their attitude towards radio to change, and also opened up opportunities for a certain businessman like Leonard Plugge to come in and, you know, use up the Irish airwaves to broadcast into Britain. As much as Radio Caroline was doing from the North Sea, Radio Ireland's transmitters was broadcasting into Britain. And by 1938, the secret documents, surveys done by the BBC showed that one of the largest listened to radio stations on the northwest of England through Manchester and Liverpool was Radio Ireland and none of the BBC channels.
Really? So there was a strong listenership up around Liverpool and Manchester. Was that mostly among the Irish diaspora or among the population in general?
Among the population in general, and that was the concern for the BBC Regional Services. And BBC in 1938 and early part of 1939, before the war started, put some extra resources into boosting transmitter power and the number of transmitters up and around the northwest to cope with Radio Éireann.
And why was Radio Éireann listened to up there? Was it because it was simply clearer than BBC, or was there something in the programming that that was enjoyed by listeners there?
Well, it was twofold. Once the powerful Athlone transmitter came on in 1933, it was widely heard across the northwest of Britain. But also, when Leonard Plugge arrived in with his sponsored programs, the commercial programs, it was almost an Americanization of radio, where this jazz music has been played, the modern music. He was already using Radio Normandy to broadcast from the north of France into London, and he was using then Athlone to broadcast into the north part of England.
And of course, the sponsor programmes were very controversial, but they lasted for decades.
Oh, they did. I mean, in fairness to Radio Éireann in its early days, when financial problems was at the heart of its issues, in 1932, 2RN or Radio Ireland, as it had slowly been turning into, earned £220 in advertising revenue in 1932. And when the sponsored programme started in 1933, they were earning £23,000. Huge jump in 1 year.
So you mentioned the competition from BBC. What kind of changes did that competition bring about eventually in Radio Éireann throughout the 30s, 40s, into the 50s? What were the issues that they dealt with that maybe they wouldn't have if there hadn't been the BBC in their back garden?
Well, the main issue that, well, unfortunately, whereas radio was progressing nicely up to 1939, the issue became in 1939, the Second World War, and everything was stifled. And everything that, any advances that had been made were suddenly stopped. And again, the problem with resources became a major problem for Radio Éireann, where during the war they had to reduce the transmitter power to try and save money, the number of hours they were broadcasting. So it became an issue. But there... problem from the BBC was that you had Radio Ireland was one channel and they were attempting to broadcast to the whole of Ireland to accommodate everybody, whereas you had a number of stations along the west coast of Britain, from Liverpool to Manchester to Wales, even down as far as Bristol, were all able to broadcast into Ireland. So people were tuning around, they were band scanning to find out the kind of music they were looking for.
So television then came in the 1960s, and what kind of an impact did that have on radio in Ireland, do you think?
Radio in Ireland was still, television, again, the same issue that would have been the problem for radio in the 1920s is that rich people could afford new radio sets. So again, when it came to the 1960s and television, the richer people could afford the television sets, and people were less, especially in rural Ireland, were less listening to radio. And the fact when RT television started, it didn't cover the whole of Ireland. Again, they concentrated on the major cities. So again, rural Ireland didn't see much television, perhaps nearly till the 1970s.
So do you think it was really in the 1970s that television began to overtake radio as the main medium?
It overtook radio as the main medium insofar as they were able to, it was imported television, imported programming. Radio was still very much domestic. It was Irish. It was, they knew the person. There was the Gay Burns on the radio. There was Joe Linane. They knew it was the personality driven for radio. And that's what they were comfortable with. Television was different. It probably caused more issues for the authorities and for the church, that it was diluting and it was probably emboldening to some of the younger generation, which in itself, the revolutionary period of the 60s, would lead into pirate radio.
Of course, and that, I was just going to come along to that question, so it's very timely. The pirates, of course, broke onto the scene in Britain in the late 60s and were hugely popular in Ireland. And then our own domestic pirate scene really got going. I mean, we've talked about this a lot before, but what would you see as the highlights of those years in relation to Irish radio?
Well, it changed. Whereas the 1930s was the evolution of radio, the 1980s was the revolution of Irish radio. It's when the likes of Chris Carey and Robbie Robinson arrived and they discovered such lax laws in this country where the loopholes have been found, and that stations in the late 70s, we'll say like ARD and Radio Dublin and Big D, were not just hobby stations broadcasting from someone's bedroom for a couple of hours on a late Saturday night or early Sunday morning. These were now broadcasting 7 days a week, often at that stage from 7 to midnight or 7 to 1 a.m. And then Carey arrived and Robbie Robinson arrived and they began broadcasting 24/7 with very powerful, very clean transmitters with the kind of music that the young people of that day actually wanted to listen to. And once they got the listenership, of course, the advertisers followed and again became an industry.
And we've discussed before, I mean, the significance of the pirates for the Irish cultural scene in general and their impact. And it's something we come back to again and again on this programme. But why do you think the pirates have received so little scholarly interest? I mean, the last book really on the pirates of any significance, I think, was probably Peter Mulryan's book from Radio Radio from 1988. You deal with them very in great depth in this book. So why the gap and why the lack of interest given their cultural importance?
Partly for a time because of the illegality, some people just didn't want to talk about their participation within illegal radio. Some didn't want to talk about it because they had moved on to legal radio and they didn't want to rock any ships. But now it's 30 years on since the Great Closures. There's a little bit more of a willingness to make sure the story is out there. And I think, you know, yourself and Brian Green have done a great job to try and encourage people to speak about it. You know, going back to October, to that great event where so many turned up and actually were willing to talk about it and willing to be interviewed. If you had done that 10 years earlier, you would have probably got five people out.
And I think we could probably repeat that in towns around the country and get even more people out. And it's really just a question of resources and time, but maybe we'll do it yet. So to come back to the book then, Eddie, and, you know, obviously the 80s was crucial, as we've said, but then we have the legalisation of 1989 and a very different animal comes to the airwaves. So how do you deal with that period, with the licensing of independent and community radio in Ireland?
Well, it seemed to be the natural progression from the free-for-all that pirate radio, especially from the authorities' point of view, the free-for-all that was the frequencies of the pirate era, especially mid-80s towards the late 80s, where it was AM, FM, shortwave. It was, you know, a free-for-all. And it was causing some issues that the government were coming under pressure from British authorities, from Ofcom, from the European authorities to make sure, you know, that we regulated our airways. There was political instability in the early 80s, which helped not allowing any white papers to become all these bills coming through, not to become acts. But eventually, by 87, the decision was made that you would have to close the pirates, but you would also have to have an alternative. So the IRTC was created to put out the new licenses, the new franchises for independent and commercial radio. And, of course, the word commercial radio, and therefore it was big business. No longer was it the hobby pirate, and you had to pay your taxes, and it became big business, and you had to have some money behind you when you were setting up the stations. So the pirates were, they were a little bit, as they say, flahoolock with paying bills and paying taxes. This was now regulation from a government and authority point of view. And therefore, it was an industry. And where the pirates began the industry and created the need for the industry, it was the new legislation in 1888 and 89 that created what is the radio industry today.
And do you deal with the question of what radio in Ireland has become, looking back from the standpoint of 2000, looking back over all the changes of the last century? Do you talk about what the product is now, what the experience is now, and perhaps even what it could be or how things could have been different?
I analyse more of the earlier decades. I do analyse slightly the later part, but again, you know, I stop in the year 2000. By 2000, the reason I stopped in 2000 and picked a century only is that radio had become stagnant. The radio stations hadn't changed much. The personalities on the air hadn't changed much, and radio became a very, it was just there. There was no innovation in radio when it came to 2000. Pirates had more or less been put off the air. I know there was some still around. There was probably, people asked me why didn't I cover more of the like of Black Tuesday and that. But again, I had to stop at a point.
Black Tuesday being the big close downs of 2003, I think, was when there was raids on pirates
major
in Dublin, especially.
Like the dance pirates, like again. But again, dance pirates, there was a need for them. There was no alternative. I mean, unfortunately, or fortunately, depends on what way you look at it, there are still dance pirates on the air today. And that's an area of, you know, the industry that nobody is covering. I know it's probably not commercial, but again, there are listeners. And, you know, I can go out in the street and I have young children myself, and some of them listen to these dance pirates because that's the music they want to listen to. And it's, you know, as far as they're concerned, it's almost commercial free, so it's even easier to listen to.
Eddie, is there anything else that we haven't covered that you'd like to draw attention to as you look back over this book?
Just to say that the book itself is, it's a lifetime's work. I hope it is interesting. I mean, there's some good stories in it. It's 595 pages, so there's a lot of work in it, and the print is quite small, so there's a lot of reading in it. There's 1,200 pirate radio, I'm not there, 1,195 pirate radio station histories.
Wow.
And that's just Irish pirate radio station histories.
And how much detail do you give about each station?
Some are just one lines, because that's probably only on for a couple of days. Radio Nova has 15, 20 pages, probably same with Radio Dublin. I do cover the fact, some of the darker aspects of Radio Dublin, because while it is not a nice subject, it is part of the history.
Absolutely.
I cover the political pirate radio scene in the north. I've done a major thing on 1969 to 73, which is a huge era of pirate radio of the North. Until I started researching myself, I didn't realise how influential it was on the events on the early part of the Troubles in both Derry and Belfast. And I covered the likes of the Border Blasters, which goes into the 80s and 90s. And I covered the first person to be convicted of pirate radio broadcasting, Michael Madden, in 1935 in Limerick. Sean McNeely became the first man in the world to die in hunger strike in 1940, having been convicted of pirate radio broadcasting here in Ireland. So there's a wide range of things. I even blow an urban myth out of the water, which was that Radio Erin were the first station in the world to broadcast an episode of The Saint.
They weren't?
No, they weren't. If you look up online, you'll find that it says, most of the fan site says that Radio Erin was. What happened was in 1939, at the outbreak of World War II, the British government asked De Valera's government to synchronise Radio Erin's transmitters. And at that stage, De Valera refused, and the BBC were ordered by Churchill to set aside 3 transmitters along the west coast of Britain to rebroadcast Radio Erin's signals. So that, again, having boosted the local transmitter network to try and outdo Radio Erin, here were BBC being told to rebroadcast Radio Erin.
That's some story.
Yeah, so that's covered in the book, and how the Saint wasn't actually on Radio Erin, it was actually on the BBC, but people were tuning in to a channel who they thought was Radio Erin. It was actually the BBC, because at that stage, RT or Radio Erin had synchronised their frequencies.
Very good. So for anybody who wants to get the book, Eddie, how do they go about it? How can it be ordered?
You can order it online to Amazon. It's available on paperback or Kindle. If you just go into amazon.co.uk and put into the search engine A Century of Irish Radio, you'll find the book there.
Eddie Bowen, congratulations on your lifetime achievement, and thanks very much for joining us on the programme today, and the best of luck.
Thanks, John. Cheers.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Dublin City FM is Ireland's longest-running licensed community radio station, having been set up in June 1992 as Annalivia FM. Community radio officially didn't exist in the early 90s, as the government had prioritised the licensing of commercial local stations, but Annalivia was initially established as a special interest station in response to the demands of community groups in Dublin for representation in the new radio landscape. The station is partly funded by Dublin City Council and changed its name in 2001 to Dublin City FM. It continues to broadcast a mix of specialist music, talk and current affairs programmes, as well as traffic updates. Hazel Lake, production and technical manager at Dublin City FM, tells us more about the station.
It's always been about community. It's always been community based. Even when we weren't a community license, which we are now since last year, we were always community ethos. So it was always about the community and doing programmes that evolved the community in it. So before all the licences and everything like that, that was exactly what the whole station was about.
Community development, essentially.
Community development, yeah. So that was what it was always about. And they've always had involvement from the community in the station. It was grouped up together. Michael D. Higgins, when he was in the arts department, he helped get the broadcast license for it, as far as I know. There was a lot of involvement in that. Now it's exactly the same ethos. Now we're actually labelled a community radio station now, instead of a multicultural license or something, whatever it is. But instead of that, now we're actually now labelled a community radio station, and we do cover the whole of Dublin. So we cover like every part of Dublin, basically, as long as the signal goes there, unless there's mad walls or something like that block it, and even sometimes outside of it, depending as well. So it's a fantastic radio station. I love it. We are very supportive of the community. We're very supportive of playing Irish artists as well. Like, we'd often give them their first ever airplay on the station, which I absolutely love, because that's my love of it. Like, you know, and it's sometimes me that gives them like their first play, but we're not like playlisted. We're allowed to play whatever music we want, you know, that kind of stuff. As long as there's not like curse words or swear words or, you know, the usual kind of thing in it. Like, you know, so it's a great little station.
And is it difficult to be a community radio station for such a large city? Because a lot of community radio stations are very local, very, very small. geographically, but you're dealing with a city of well over a million people with lots of different communities in it. So how do you manage that?
It's an interesting one because we have a couple of different shows. We've got like a Russian show, we've got a Polish show, a Chinese show. Then we've got one that's Europe Today, so it discusses like, you know, kind of like European issues and things as well. So we've got different multicultural actual like shows based on those. We have a Brazilian show as well, actually. Another one's just new as well. We used to have an African show. You know, it depends. It does depend on who's available as well. We have an Irish, a couple of Irish shows as well that are Oscuelga. It can be quite difficult sometimes, but we do tend to do a really good job. Like, we will usually cover a lot of stuff with the Good Morning Dublin show. That might have a lot of local issues that are happening at the time. It could be a festival that's happening in Smithfield. It could be, you know, a reading group that's happening out in, you know, some other part of Dublin. So we do have stuff like that, and like different festivals will come up, and like we've got a Greek film festival coming up, and we've got advertisements for that on our station, and, you know, different bits like that. So we do actually do very, very good job at covering a lot of the stuff. You can't cover every nationality. We only have a certain amount of time, you know. But we are like, we're 60-40% talk versus music, okay, as well. So we do cover quite a lot of that in our remit, what we're doing. So okay, it's not bad.
And can you tell me a little bit about the volunteers then? How many people roughly are involved, and what kind of backgrounds are they from, and how do you keep them on board?
Do you know what? Volunteers are very funny in our station. So we'll have volunteers who are there, they'll come in. If they get a job, they have to go, you know, that kind of thing. Social welfare is an issue as well a lot of the time, because, you know, people who are volunteers, a lot of the time they want to come in and they want to help us volunteer. And, you know, they're trying to keep their foot in the door. They might just finish college and they can't get a job, or, you know, that kind of stuff. They might be on social welfare. If you're on social welfare don't really like that because we're not considered a volunteer sector. But they're not getting paid. I think the social welfare kind of think that these people are getting paid for doing this job, but they're not, you know. So that can be a little bit of an issue sometimes, because obviously, like, you know, the social welfare are trying to get people off of the social welfare schemes and onto jobs, like, you know, and working in jobs. So that's one of the issues we'd have with volunteers. Like, you know, they go off, get their jobs, or, you know, they can't do it anymore because they have to get a different job or they need the cash, you know. So it's very difficult. We've got a difference. So they're kind of the younger ones, whatever. We've got other volunteers that run and do shows.
They'd be working anyway, maybe, the other volunteers. Yeah, they do it for the love of it.
So, like, you know, the other ones are the ones, like, so maybe a lot of the presenters, all the presenters are volunteers. So, they might be retired and doing it, or they could be, like, you know, they have their other job and they're working it around as you said, as a hobby, you know. And they do their music show and then they go back to work the next day and it's their thing. So it's just outside of work. This is their hobby, you know. But they generally all have done radio, or they wanted to do radio, or they've had, you know, something, some kind of an interest in it, and that's kind of where it works. And it's a really nice community in there. Yeah.
So do you know roughly how many volunteers there would be then?
It depends on the show. It really does depend on it, like, because we have people come in and out. So you have people at the weekend. There must be over 200 volunteers throughout the week, you know, you're dealing with that. Plus then the people that kind of come in and out, like during the summer, we have interns that come over from America and Germany and France and stuff like that as well. And they're over on an internship, you know. So that's kind of one thing that we have during the summer as well. And then we have maybe college students will come in during the summer for work experience as well. So you kind of top them up there as well on top of it. So I'm dealing with a good couple hundred people a week when I'm in there, so it's quite.
It must be a bit of a scheduling nightmare if there's a lot of change or flux in people coming and going. How do you ensure that you deliver your schedule, or is the schedule changing a lot? Or?
No, it doesn't. Like, our schedule only changes really every 12 weeks or so. Like, you know, the actual, like, for the programs go to, like, every 12 weeks. Like, you know, so it's every 2 months that the schedule changes, or there might be a change in the actual schedule. We found it difficult to find Gaelgors, to find people to do Irish shows that were all in Irish, that for our thing. We have found it difficult to do that. There's one or two things that we might find difficult as well, like sports maybe would be another one, like, you know, certain things about sports, like everybody loves football, but you don't want to be covering football, like, it's not local, it's nothing to do with Ireland. So, like, we kind of say, no, you can't be covering soccer in the UK. We don't care about Manchester United and Liverpool. We want to know about the college sports, you know. And it's very difficult to get into that if you don't have the connections and stuff. So that could be quite difficult for someone as well. But in general, we actually are okay. And there's a few people in there. Like, we've got one person who's very good. He can cover all the sports and he's just retired. So he's like, I'm here all the time. So if anybody's ever stuck, you can contact him and he'll have a contact, you know. So we work as a group, I think, as a thing. We're all very helpful with each other. So if someone is short, an interview, it's generally like, okay, what do we have on stock? Or, you know, have you done an interview this week that I might be able to repeat? Or, you know, something like that. And you just kind of like work with everybody in the studio. And it happens, like sometimes you do, like, you know, yourself, you do an interview and you've organised your interview and then they just don't, like, answer the phone, or they, you know, disappear, or, you know, something happens. They get stuck in traffic and they can't make it. So then something will end up getting fixed then on top of that, you know. And we just work together really well as a group and work together in that way, and it pulls through.
So just the last question then is in relation to the community radio sector in general. What are your thoughts about it, having been involved now for a number of years? What do you think the future holds for community radio in Ireland?
I think it's an essential thing to have in Ireland. Like, if you're even down to music, Irish bands don't get played very much on commercial radio, and commercial radio is playlisted, whereas we can play whatever music we want as long as it's, like, you know, under our remit or whatever. So I think it's vital for us to have it, because also it covers community issues. And like, most community radio stations cover the small sectors, so like northeast side of a bill, like, you know, Near FM is like northeast radio, so they cover northside radio, so they cover there. You know, you've got Liffey FM, you've got Phoenix, they're covering out that side of Dublin as well,
South.
Like, you know, Dublin South, you've got all these kind of smaller little ones that cover a certain area, and they can target the area, so they can go, okay, grand, there's something happening with the local shop down the road, they get evicted or something, they can cover something like that, you know. And whereas it wouldn't make it like an RTE news or a Today FM news or a, you know, a bigger thing like that. And, you know, it's good for the local people to know about the stuff that's going on and get involved. And, you know, like, you wouldn't have a small little drama group that's like, you know, your nephews or your kids, like, you know, getting any sort of radio coverage on RTE unless they did something massive, you know. So it's really nice to give them that as well and give back to the community in that way. And I think we need community radio.
And do you think it's healthy, the sector, or do you think is it threatened, or what's your sense of that?
I don't think we're threatened. I think we threaten the bigger stations, because if we actually had our JNLR levels or readings or whatever you want to call them, I think we'd actually have more listenership than some of their shows. And that means we'd be taken away from, like, if commercially, advertising companies or people want to do adverts and stuff like that decided, you know, actually, like, we'll go to a community radio station, it's cheaper for us, and they've got the same people, you know, the amount of people listening to that show as they're listening to on the other show, then that'd be their money gone, you know. I think that's a little bit of a threat. I think we are a threat to the bigger stations, and we do everything on a shoestring budget, you know. And I've listened to some of the stuff on commercial radio, and we produce better quality things than some of the stations that have a huge funding or a huge budget, or, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's interesting when you come to that, like, that we can make better things, better quality shows compared to something that has more money, you know. And when that happens, and when it turns around that people realise that, and they're coming to us to, like, you know, go and advertise with us, or, you know, go talk about their shows with us, bigger acts come and talking to us, like, you know, that kind of stuff. When that happens, when that turnaround happens, then people will be listening to us more than anything else, because they'll get sick of hearing the same songs over and over again. They'll get sick of hearing the same voices over and over again. They'll want to hear different things and just get more stuff out of it and be more involved.
Hazel Lake of Dublin City FM, and you can listen to the station on 103.2 in Dublin and on dublincityfm.ie.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
And finally, to an often overlooked part of the Irish radio landscape, hospital radio. Ireland has 5 hospital radio stations, 4 of which have been on air since the legalisation of independent radio 30 years ago. But one station, St Eta's Hospital Radio, based in Port Ran in North County Dublin, first came on the air as a pirate station in 1983 and was the first station in Ireland to receive a licence under the new regime. Brian Green spoke to station manager Tom Nocter.
Well, the radio station here started in 1984 in around there as a pirate radio, believe it or not, even though it was a HSE.
Weren't we all back then?
We've been on air ever since, with one small break around 94 we went off. We were the first station to receive a license. We were the first license station. I don't even think RTE or 2FM actually had a physical license. Obviously, they were the government-run station. So I think we're the first station to receive a license, and we received that in the form of a dispensation to remain on air. As you know, anyone involved in radio will know, when the local licenses were being issued in 1987, part of the deal to get a license for existing stations was that they had to go off air.
On the 31st of December, yeah.
Yeah, so we got a dispensation from the then Minister for Communication, who gave us a letter allowing us to remain on air while we applied for our licence. So that is, to our mind, technically, that is the first licence that was ever issued.
Brilliant.
I've seen that document myself in many, many moons ago. It's probably long gone now, but I did see it when I came here in 1994 into the radio station. I was working in the hospital beforehand, and a vacancy came up here in the station. I had a history with pirate radio, as a lot of us youngsters did, and someone here, one of the managers here, found out and asked me would I come on board and help present a bit. So I did that for a short while, and then the manager's vacancy came up. And I applied for that and was successful. So this has been my job. This is my job to run the radio station here at St. Edith's since 1994 until now, 25 years here this year, I think, in the radio station.
That dispensation would have been offered to you because you were coming from the campus of St. Edith's Portrane, and it was one of the country's largest mental health institutions. You had a listenership who needed the radio.
That's right. We had a listenership here who we had a huge listenership, or a huge amount of residents at that time. We would have been heading towards the thousands, I'd imagine. And we were given dispensation because the clients loved it so much. They loved their music. They used to be able to ring in here and get their requests played, and they still can, of course. And that dispensation was applied for. The management here applied for it with the manager of the radio station at the time, applied with the minister, and he saw fit to allow us to continue. So that's how that happened, yeah.
And so what kind of numbers did you have back then, and how many would you have now?
Oh, we had on the campus, yeah. Back then it would have been, I'd say there'd be maybe more than 1,000 people back then. Not 100% sure. I only came on to the hospital here in 89, and there was probably more than 1,000 here at that stage. But in 83, 84, when it came on, there would have been even more, because Cairn, the community, was only sort of starting off then. Now, on the campus here, I think there'd be only 200 or 300 on the campus, if there would even be that. There's no psychiatric unit on the grounds here at St. Edith's anymore. It's all people with learning disabilities. Of course, they are building the new mental health hospital, or the Dundrum, the replacement for Dundrum, here on the grounds at the minute. I think that's to open 2021 or something like that. It's going well. You can see it just as you're driving up the avenue to the right, and it seems to be going up at a pace.
More listeners for St. Edith's Radio. You're on 89.5 on the FM. You stream online, and your programming is to entertain the campus and your listeners abroad and around the country as well.
Yeah, it's well, we're broadcasting on 89.5 FM on low power, reasonably low power. I think it's 10 watts or something like that we're licensed for. So that doesn't get very, very far. You can hear it in Swords if you really want to.
Baldoyle, if you're like me.
Yeah, if you're on the coast. Of course, we're lucky we're right on the coast, and FM signal is line of sight. So up and down the coast, you'll get it further. But once you start heading inland, it disappears quite quickly. Be crackly in that, so you'd really want to listen to it when you compared it to the likes of the quality of the audio around us. Once you get inland, we'd be going off. getting a bit weaker. So, but we're also streaming online, and the reason we did that was we had a lot of, I mentioned care in the community, and we have a lot of people who moved out of here, out into houses in Howth, Malahide, Rush, Lusk, Ballybuckle, places like that. There's houses that are attached to St. Edith's campus, and our FM signal wouldn't have been strong enough to get to those. So what we did was we started to stream. So any of those houses have the facility to listen to us on phones now, of course. It's all phones or into computers, anything with internet radios or whatever. So it means the people moving out of here don't lose the link with their friends. As I mentioned earlier, they'd be playing requests for one another and stuff like that, birthdays and whatever. So they still can have that link out in the community. A plus side of that is that when you're streaming on the internet, you can be heard anywhere in the world. And we have over 1,000 people who actually follow our stream, who like it on the TuneIn app. And we have, I looked at the logs there recently, and it was something like we'd had 800 listeners in that month over 87 different countries.
Wow.
Blew me away.
Yeah. Are you a station that encourages service users, or what you used to call them, patients,
yes,
to access the station? Like, do you take them on air at all?
We have three service users, not all of this service, but three who I would class as people, service users, who are actually on air presenting a show. We've one on there at the minute. We have Jack, Stereo Jack, who was world famous. Everyone knows Stereo Jack, and Jack was a service user here back in the 80s and early 90s, and he's actually second. He actually helps me run the place here on the voluntary capacity. He comes in and opens up and looks after the other presenters and that. And we have a chap who travels up from Gorey. He's a service user down in Gorey, and comes up on the train twice a week, actually, and presents a show and goes off home again afterwards. So, yeah, well, certainly anyone from any service that would be interested. Like, it's very therapeutic, broadcasting and music in general, of course. So anyone, we would certainly have a leaning towards training those people in if they had an interest in and made themselves known to us. We've always had service users involved in the presenting on air side. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Tom Nocters, who we're talking to, he's manager of St. Edith's Hospital Radio. And Tom, can you tell me, like, you just mentioned something there, the power of radio to heal, to be involved in it and take part and be in a team, that must give people huge confidence boost.
It does, of course. And there was a study, a hospital radio, there's three hospital radio stations left in Ireland. There's ourselves, there's Cork University Hospital in Cork, obviously, and there's South Tipperary General Hospital in Clonmel. We did have the Mater, Beaumont, and Limerick. There's one in Limerick. They've all since closed down, unfortunately. Limerick only recently. But it's big in the UK. There's a huge hospital radio body in the UK, and they have the Hospital Broadcasting Authority, which is its overseeing body. And they did a study last year on the benefits of hospital radio to patient care and recovery, more in a general hospital than ourselves, which is a residential unit. But the findings of that study are online, and it's very beneficial, very, 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 very therapeutic for people in hospital to have access to the music they want to hear when they want to hear it, and also to know what's going on around. And it sort of eases the stress of being in hospital, of course.
The hospital radio crowd in the UK, I think they passed their centenary. Like, they've been on air like 100 years nearly on broadcasting. Why do you think it's so kind of hit and miss in Ireland?
I think it's down to finance in Ireland. I mean, we have to say it's quite expensive to run. It used to be, it is now. I mean, we have to pay the broadcast levy. We're not allowed to take any advertising, so that's €1,000 straight off to go on air. We also have to, we have basically the same guidelines as community stations anyway. The commercial ones are probably a bit more stringent, but certainly community stations. But we don't have the facility to earn the funds. So it is quite on with the current climate here. It is difficult to get hospital administrators to commit to funding that. There's also the equipment can be quite expensive and stuff like that. So I think basically, I think that's it really. It is down to finances and the current climate. Like those three stations I mentioned that closed, all closed since 2007, since the levy came in, the broadcast levy. And I know, I've been told by the managers there, we had our own hospital authority here in Ireland, our own setup, like the Irish Hospital Radio Network, where we all met and discussed stuff. And I've been told that the levy was a problem was certainly a factor in the closure of those three stations. Yeah.
Can I propose a suggestion, maybe, if the Minister for Health is listening, and they have these monitors, so if their name is mentioned, automatically they'll get something on their desk saying they were mentioned on the radio. So what's his name? Simon Harris, if you're listening, Hospital Radio, could you talk to Richard Bruton over in communications about the levies being abolished for community and institutional licences? Because they're supposed to be doing that. It's part of government policy that they would abolish licences and have the licences for the commercials. That's another thing altogether. But maybe if Simon Harris is listening, because I think Hospital Radio, and you're from a HSE campus, if you could be helping the HSE with all the messages that they have to tell the whole population of the whole country about health.
Yes, exactly. Well, and it's the HSE that pay the levy here. So, I mean, it's I could never understand it, to be honest, the politics or the red tape of it, because it's one government department paying another. And surely there would be some easy way of saying, for institutional stations anyway, and I suppose the community stations as well, they do great work, that just to waiver the levy or whatever. I mean, we're not allowed to take advertising. If we were allowed to take advertising, I would imagine we would be able to generate the funding for we've a lot of goodwill in that in the community, but we're just not allowed to do it under our licensing agreement. So I would imagine that our hands are tied, and it is €1,000 plus, it's 700 and something plus VAT, so it's the guts of €1,000 every year. You know.
Tom Nocture of St. Edith's Hospital Radio in Dublin. And you can listen to St. Edith's Hospital Radio locally in North Dublin on 89.5 FM or online at hospitalradio.ie. And that's it for the April edition of Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. We'll be back on the first Monday in May with more radio news and features. But in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and facebook.com/wirelessflirt. Until next month, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.